Welcome, everybody. We appreciate you coming out today. I'm Eric Droutman.
My name is Ferry Normeling.
We are both Fast Track architects with the Fast Track Center. We work a lot with some of our larger customers and help them understand the Fast Track Center and align to the Fast Track Center. Both of us have been doing this work for quite a few years. Myself, I started working with the predecessor to Office 365, BPOS, back in 2008, and I actually deployed the fourth ever customer to BPOS dedicated back then. So just a few years doing this stuff. And what we're going to present to you today is some tips and tricks of things to help you get started, a lot of the long pull items and the things to think about so that as you're thinking about getting deployed, you can get some of this stuff done, and then when your boss says, get me deployed now, you're not like, oh, I guess I need to get started now, and it's going to be a while. No, we don't want it to be a while. We want you to get the value out of this as quick as you possibly can. So some of the things that we're going to talk about dealing early is some of the critical success factors, things to think about: the tenant, identity, network. Network is a long pole. We'll talk about Office clients and then some other things to consider.
But also very important, this is an interactive session, so if we don't get through all the slides because you ask lots of questions, we'll consider it a success as well.
Aha.
It is on.
Okay. Turn it up.
She's turning me up. That's a new experience. Some of the critical success factors for Office 365, we call them DIBS, D-I-B-S. Basically, if you're at the start of your project, you have not identified these four critical success factors, basically you're setting yourself up for some sort of failure somewhere down the line. So anytime you start a cloud migration project, make sure that you know the due date for go live. So when do you actually start, when do you actually need to finish your deployment? Is it in December of a year, for instance, or is it in January? Make sure that you take into account IT free spirits, etc. When do you actually want to have your users migrated into production?
Yeah, set a goal is really what that amounts to.
Yeah, the second one is intent, which workloads? Office 365 is, of course, a huge suite. So for all intents and purposes, you can decide, I want to do everything at once. But you might also decide that you want to do Exchange first, Skype for Business first, Yammer first, or a combination of those. So make sure that you call out in your project planning what you actually want to do. We're going to move to Office 365 in and by itself is a good thing, but please put a little more detail in there as well so you know what you're actually getting yourself into. The third one, what is the business reason? This is an IT conference, of course, so most of the people here mainly focus on the IT part of the migration. But we do this for a reason. So whatever your reason is for migrating to Office 365, please do make sure that you capture that, because if you have a valid business reason, the last one is a lot easier. You also need a business sponsor to successfully migrate to Office 365, because you will hit bumps along the road, and you need someone on the business side of things who can actually smoothen things over in your journey there. So the last two are tied together. If you have a valid business reason, you are certain to have a valid business sponsor as well, and you need that person to make sure that you transition smoothly to Office 365.
So two things to quickly add on that. When we say business sponsor, again, business, the director of infrastructure, that's IT. You know, the head of sales, that's a business sponsor. And I'll give you just a very quick example. A customer I'm dealing with right now, they have a problem where their users want to move in and out. So they're scheduling the user, and the user's saying last week, oh, I can't do it now. And then, oh, I need to be added now. But it's more the, I can't do it now. That's an example where you don't have a business sponsor, because if there's a business sponsor, then IT can say, you need to move now, not I'd like you to move now, and then the business says no. So that's part of that. Working on this list, we have something called the success plan. And Angie, who's over there later this afternoon at 1:35, is going to be doing a presentation on the success plan. And in the success plan, there's a lot of questions that will help you think through this process and write it down. Because as we all know, writing it down is an important extra step. So the first topic to think about is, what are you going to call your tenant? Sounds like a really simple thing. It is fairly simple, but a lot of people have different thoughts on it. And it's important because once you pick it, you really can't change it. You're going to see it in a number of places. SharePoint is the biggest place that you see it. So that tenant name will show up in your SharePoint name. Less important in Link, if you're doing a conference call and a meeting link, you'll see it in there. And then you'll also see it as a system in system email addresses. It's not just an IT question. It's a marketing and a communications question. Get your buy off of them, or you're going to discover you're going to be partway through the project, and then they're going to say, "Whoa, that's not a valid use of our trademark," or things like that. We've both seen that before. Have the discussion.
And one thing I wanted to add to that, so if you have that discussion, make sure you have alternates ready. So for instance, if you're called Philips, like the arena next door, Philips is also very large, that's why the arena is named that way, it's a large electronics company, but it's also, of course, a very common name in mid-market, whatever, Philips screwdriver, whatever. So please make sure you have an alternate ready. So if, for instance, you're named Philips, but that name is already taken, maybe Philips LTD for a UK company might be a good way of them, or Philips Inc. for a US company might be a good alternate, but make sure you have those alternatives ready.
And I'll even add on top of that, if you're just right now thinking, in a year, I'm going to go migrate, try to grab the name now. Set up a trial account, grab it now, you have it. And somebody else can't slip through.
Yeah. But if you do make sure that you capture who registered that domain, because we find that quite a lot of customers say, "I want philips.onmicrosoft.com." We are, for privacy reasons, not allowed to divulge the person that registered that account. So if you find, but we can see, for instance, that the person that registered actually works for your company. So we do find, because, for instance, CRM Online, Intune, are all Microsoft Cloud properties that have that same tenant. So you might, from an IT perspective, migrating to Office 365, not know that a CRM trial has started or an Intune trial has started, and that name is already registered within that company, within your company. So if you do find that the name is already taken, you might send an email to your IT department asking the entire group, did someone register this Office 365 tenant name? If so, please come forward so we can reuse the name going forward. Very important to know. The next one, identity. So identity, of course, is a very important part of your move to the cloud, and there are quite a few things you can do before we actually start implementing a form of directory synchronization. So if you are in an organization that still does not have a routable UPN as your user principal name, make sure you start that transition now. There is no way you can use a non-routable UPN for Office 365, period. There are some things out there about having alternate ID, stuff like that. Please, please, please do not go down that route, because it will not lead to a good user experience. So if you have the time, make sure that you capture early a path towards a routable UPN. Secondly, if you come from a non-Exchange email system, predominantly Lotus Notes, make sure that you start adding the right information to your Active Directory now. Because if that is something that you have to do as part of your migration project itself, it will cost you a lot of time and money in preparation for the actual migration being done by the FTC, because the actual copy out of a Notes directory into Active Directory is not part of the FTC benefit. We do migrate your email included in our service. That comes included in what you get from us, but the actual preparations in copying Active Directory accounts or copying your accounts into Active Directory is not part of our service. So that's something you need to do. Other decisions, very important. It is from a end user perspective, it's easiest to have your user principal name, your email address, and your SIP the same. There is, however, something to think about because that also exposes your UPN as part of your email address. So it might be something you need to discuss with security before going forward. But from an end user perspective, this is the best way to deliver the service. You have to think about what sort of identity integration you're going to set up with Office 365. Also have to think about whether or not you're going to turn on password sync as part of your directory synchronization. It's a very bad name for that feature because we do not sync your password. We sync the hash of your password. But that's a very good thing as a disaster recovery option. So if you do turn on federated identity later on and you find that for some reason your federated identity setup breaks down, at least you can switch back to a cloud identity and have your users log into the servers while you recover from the disaster you're in. Also very important, if this is a new tenant, the first account you set up is actually the global admin account, and as ever, with great power comes great responsibility. So the choices you have for identities in Active Directory are threefold. The first is very simple. You don't do any integration between your current Active Directory and the cloud. You set up all identities in the cloud itself. That's a perfectly valid scenario for testing out the functions and features, or for a first deployment where, for instance, you're only doing Office Pro Plus activation in the cloud. The main thing you do have to take into account is that if you want to turn on directory synchronization at a later stage, we can do a soft match of the accounts that live in your Active Directory and the accounts that you already set up in Office 365, but then do make sure that the email address is the same because that's what the basis for our soft match in that case. As soon as you turn this on, actually, your on-premise AD becomes what we call the source of authority. So you are still able to make changes over here, but they will get overwritten as soon as you have another Delta sync, because on-premise is the source of identity then. Also then, in that synchronized identities, you have the password hash option. Again, if you're just doing, for instance, an Office Pro Plus deployment at the time, there's no real user data in the cloud. A federated identity might be a bit overshooting what you're trying to achieve, and then syncing the password hash so users at least have a single password experience is a quite good way to start. Lastly, of course, you can also set up ADFS as an identity option, and setting up both directory synchronization based on AAD Connect or implementing Active Directory Federation services is part of the fast track benefit, so we will actually help you set this up. If you're using a third party identity provider, I won't say you're on your own, but that's not part of the fast track center benefit.
But here, what the focus here again is what you want to be thinking about ahead of time, you know, having those conversations with the security group and everybody else, and decide, okay, this is the way I want to go. Don't necessarily get started. If you want to, great. If you don't, we'll help you. But at least that way you start getting that thought process and you're not having to go through five levels of approval when you're ready to start implementing. Yeah. So
that's what we discussed. Yeah. Also, one important thing to remember, global address book. So if you do not turn on any form of directory synchronization, you have to think of another way to populate your global address book in Exchange, because it actually depends on a filled address book. And there are also some ways to scope that if necessary, but that's the last one you need to take into account.
Right. So network is a long pole because, probably most of the people here aren't the network people, but we know when we work with the network people, it's always about buying new equipment. It's about provisioning new network lines, and that takes time. You know, you ask AT&T to bring in another T3, and you're going to be waiting for a while. So thinking about this ahead is really important. So some of the things that you want to think about. Do you have everyone going in and out of the same internet connector? If you do, what happens if it goes down? Your mail's now in the cloud. That may not be a great thing. Are you international? If you're international, how do your people connect? Do they come, let's say you're a company out of Germany, does everybody go first to Germany and then out the internet? Or do the US people come out of a US internet connection and the German people come out of the German. That's the better way, because when you do that, they're going to get quickly out to our network, and then travel through Microsoft faster to the data centers. Next thing to think about is, what's your capacity? It's not just about bandwidth, it's also about your IP addresses and ports. So everybody knows about the bandwidth, and that's what everybody's always focused on. I've got 5,000 users, and do the calculation, I'm gonna need, you know, a T3, whatever that amount is. What the ports is about is, if you've got a lot of people using Outlook, and that T3 to the internet is behind a single firewall with a single IP address, so everybody's going out of the same IP address, well, Outlook uses a bunch of ports. If you have 5,000 people, and each of those people is using 10 to 20 ports going to the same address, you're gonna run out of ports on the firewall. And then people are gonna start disconnecting, and it's gonna be a bad user experience. So in that case, you need to add multiple IP addresses. And we have links for both a bandwidth calculator and the port connection in our deck that you can download it after this talk. Here's a quick graphic as well, just to show your different possibilities. Going through a proxy server and then out to the public internet, going direct without. The preferred is to go direct, because typically your proxy servers are going to add latency to your network.
Also very important, Skype for Business does not really like the setup. So if you're going to deploy Skype for Business, especially with the more advanced scenarios like Cloud PBX or PSTN, etc., please do not use this option, because it will lead to pain further down the road.
Yep. Couple quick network connection recommendations. Well-configured direct is best. Look at latency. Again, take caution on proxy servers, and you know, look at your egress devices that they're not causing bottlenecks.
Client decisions. Very simple. Any version of Office 2010 or newer is currently supported for Office 365 from a supportability point of view. So there's, from that point of view, no need currently to upgrade to a newer version. However, if you want to use the newest features in Office 365, you need to be on a new version of Office. So for instance, if you want to use groups, if you want to use modern attachments, you need to be in Office 2016 Pro Plus for that to work correctly. Secondly, if you're going to use a form of multi-factor authentication, you need to be at least on Office 2013, because 2010 does not support modern auth as it is exposed in Office 365. So the question is it realistic to migrate into Office 365 services if you're still on the Office 2010 client? It depends on your business scenario. So if you're, for instance, if you're just migrating email because you have a burning email platform, for instance, and you have no multi-factor authentication requirement at the moment, you're perfectly fine migrating that stuff over. If, on the other hand, you rely heavily currently on SharePoint on-prem and Office 2010 integration, because there is something there, then that might not be the best scenario to start deploying early. But what the reason we called it out here, of course, is that anything that's fully within IT's control from an email migration perspective, you're in control of that migration. Usually the people that control the UC stack do not control the actual desktop. So this is something that you need to talk to your desktop people about, because this will take time if you're in a very large estate going forward. So that's the reason for calling it out here. Dependent on your migration scenario, there might not be an immediate need to update your client. However, if you want to get all the goodness that is in Office 365, please make sure that you're on Office Pro Plus, because that is the path forward for the new features that come out in Office 365. Also, of course, you can make a good distinction between the laptop bring your own device type of scenario where people can actually start deploying Office Pro Plus if it's part of your subscription right now. There's no IT involvement there. They're good to go. So they can start using the new stuff, get used to the new Office. And then, of course, your users will start banging on your door, do it on my corporate desktop as well. And that's then a migration that you can start working on.
Relationships. Now you have 500 clinical people that do not want to go that route because of the clinical legacy applications that they are dependent on, whether it's an Excel product that removes reports, or you have the actual administrative area that's gung-ho on going forward. Do you work closely with external companies or corporations that have those legacy applications to help them migrate, help them somehow move over, convince them, if you will, to make it easier?
So in a nutshell, the question is, how do we deal with legacy apps in the 2010 environment and going forward? So yes and no, we deal with that. So Eric and I do not deal directly with those third-party people, but our Office Pro Plus team, of course, does do a lot of reach out to them. Secondly, there have not been that many changes in the Office COM or the application programming model from 2010 to 2016. So there is a very good chance that the applications that run in the client on the 2010 version actually do run in the 2016 version as well. And thirdly, but it's also in the recommendations, we would suggest that you focus your initial efforts on the people that can actually move, usually the 80% of your organization, and then leave those 500 people on an older version of Office for the time being. Because that gives you, first of all, it gives you the benefit of migrating the bulk of your users to Office 365 with all the goodness that comes with it. Also, once you've done that, it should have cleared up your internal IT organization, because they don't have to manage an Exchange server anymore, they don't have to manage SharePoint anymore, they can focus on those business users to remedy the issues that they need to remedy going forward. But it's a pain point we do come across more often. But also one thing I think you need to take into account is that it is an overblown pain point for a lot of people. So a lot of people that don't want to migrate to Office 365 put up this as a potential blocker. And if you really dive into it, it's not the blocker they make it out to be, usually.
We've noticed when you're talking about clients, also the Skype for Business client as well as the Office client.
Yeah.
And the same goes for IT card phones, and we can run into several issues there, they're running different versions.
Right.
Trying to do that migration possibly.
Yeah. Point taken, I don't have a direct solution for that. Sorry, the question was, you're talking about Office clients, so software, but you should also take into account that you might have IP hard phones that need an updated version of the software, for instance, to start using Skype for Business online. Personally, I haven't run across that, but it's point taken.
Yeah. So a couple other things to consider. Coexistence increases your operational complexity. What we're talking about there is the faster that you can move from all on-prem to all in the cloud, the better. There are, you know, edge cases. I think she's the perfect example there where you may not be able to do that, but the less time that you can spend in that halfway point, the better. Particularly, I would say, when you're talking non-Exchange to Exchange, but let's say Notes to Exchange or Google to Exchange, that's where you really want to get the faster over, the better, because you're going to be getting those help desk tickets of, oh, I can't do this because such and such a person is already over and I'm not. And that just generates a lot of work. Migrate data based on business units to avoid some of the hybrid limitations. Focus on the 80% that can be migrated without an issue. Select your pilot group carefully. This is a key one. An all IT pilot group is a really bad idea. Maybe a very early pilot group that way, sure. But you need to have pilots where you've got the regular business users so that you find the things that you weren't aware of that, oh, wow, they did have that one application that is a problem. And you found that with two people that you can roll back, not with 500 people now that it's too late to roll back.
We actually did that with an offsite clinic as our pilot group. And
yep.
it's bringing
Yep. And then find, you know, one of the biggest ones, make your admin assistants happy. key to success. When they're happy, their bosses are happy. When their bosses are happy, you're happy. So.
So the question is, how long does data migration take? One important piece of advice, the fast accenter is, especially for email migrations, never the bottleneck. So we can go as fast as any organization can. So usually the limitation is much more how many migration machines are you able to spin up, what is your bandwidth that is available for this migration, and the most important one is what is the, how well are you equipped to handle the post-migration task? Because there will be questions from users, your iPhones that need to be reconfigured, for instance. So from a technical perspective, we can migrate thousands of users per week without any issue. From an end-user adoption perspective, that might not be the fastest way that you want to move. For file share migrations, there is more of, well, physics come into play as to what we are able to achieve in a week. But for email, there's no throttling on our end that will impact your migration.
So please come to the MOFAR Fast Track site, as well as come to the Fast Track booth in the Expo Center. We have a lot of different sessions going on. The next session up is the one that Andy Livermore is doing. That's that one there. But they will be going on throughout the week. And finally, please do your survey, and hopefully you liked our presentation.
Thanks for coming.
And if anybody has any questions, please come up, and we'll be glad to stand around and talk some extra.